Okay, we're moving westward. We're from Israel to New York, now in Chicago. So like I said, I'm not doing any fancy introductions, but a pleasure to welcome Sarah. And I just want to thank her and all the I use Safaria a lot. It's a tremendous source, and I want to really I know you've been working there, I think, from the beginning, actually, when Safaria got started, and Director of Education. So I want to thank her, I think, on behalf of many of us, and it's a pleasure to have her. And Vakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. And it's really, I'm glad to be learning with all of you today. Thank you all for joining Torah in Motion today. Again, my name is Sarah Wachenfeld, and I'm you know, as much as you can say you're happy on Tisha B'Av, I'm happy to be marking the day with you in this way. The sources that we'll be learning are, for me, among the most meaningful to learn on Tisha B'Av, and so I'm really glad to have this opportunity to learn them with all of you. I'm going to share my source sheet on a Google Doc, but I'm very on brand, and I'm going to, when I share my screen a little later on, I'll share with you from Safaria, and that's just because I want to be able to move among the sources in a more dynamic way, but this way you have them. For those who want to see, you have them. It's the same sheet either way. I imagine that many of you have been on Zoom much of the day already today, so my only Zoom housekeeping is just to remind you to please stay muted when not speaking. And it's a large group, so I think we'll mostly keep comments and questions to the chat, but I will be pausing for your comments and questions throughout. I would really love to hear your thoughts on these sources. And so I'm quite comfortable with any or all of you putting thoughts in the chat, both when I pause and also throughout. You should feel free to use the chat. I'm a pretty accomplished multitasker, so I will do my best to keep an eye on the chat even while I'm speaking, but I will definitely be pausing throughout to take your questions and comments. And again, you have the source sheet in the chat. My version will be the most up-to-date one, the Google Doc I shared with you, but either way. Tisha B'Av, of course, marks destruction and instability and a lack of self-confidence as a people. We lose our temple, we lose our home, we lose so much. It's echoed by losses throughout Jewish history. There's another loss that I want to focus on today, and that's a loss of a communal system for naming and coping with doubt or with uncertainty. The term I would use in Hebrew is safek, which also just means doubt or a lack of clarity, or sometimes you could maybe even call it a kind of plausible deniability. It's not something that maybe we talk about so much when we talk about Tisha B'Av, but again, I think the texts that we're going to look at today, which come from the end of the Mishnah in Tractate Sota, and also the Tosefta, the parallel text from the same time period as the Mishnah, the Tosefta, those texts take you through a kind of narrative of what it looks like for a society to disintegrate. And I was just speaking with some friends before I came on here about the experience of hearing Eicha last night, and I think it's every year it's such a powerful moment when you sit down on the floor and you hear Eicha. It's such a sad text. And I would also say that there's something overwhelming for me about Eicha, that it's like too much to take in. And part of it is because it's this snapshot of destruction, but without any sense of what came before the destruction. It almost doesn't feel as real because it's just, everything is just terrible, but you don't have a sense really from Eicha of what was before. And what the Mishnah and the Tosefta in Sota do is give you a sense of the steps that mark this destruction, the way you go from things being basically okay to really totally not okay in a short span of text. And one of the ways that the Mishnah emphasizes this kind of destruction of society, one of the sets of markers that it uses is through the loss of doubt, through the loss of safek, as a kind of system that you can recognize and you can use. So there's a certain amount of safek that's built into religious life. Part of this is on a very deep religious level, that we know that we can't know everything. And we also recognize that the only one who can know everything is God. And we have a lot of ways that we recognize that in the liturgy. In Tanakh, we say things like, Hanistarot la Hashem Elokeinu v'haniglot lanu ulvaneinu ad olam, right? Things that are hidden for us are revealed for God. There are things that are revealed for us, but everything is sort of in the revealed category for God. God knows everything. We don't know everything. That's on a deep emotional, spiritual level, a way that we deal with Safek. And then we think about it also in the very practical, in the very tachlis of our day-to-day life. Jewish law is extremely detailed and requires a lot of real-time decisions. Is the food kosher? Is the action permitted on Shabbat? Is the business deal kosher? Can you do this thing? And there's an extensive literature throughout the Talmud and beyond about how you should deal with these cases of safek. Halakha has a lot of built-in rules to deal with safek. If you can name some, you can put them in the chat. Ways that we routinely know that we come up against doubtful situations, and we just have ways to cope with them, to make that game time decision. Should I do X or should I do Y? Can I eat this food or can I not eat this food? That's safek on the most practical level. And all of these rules that we have about dealing with safek, so you could think about making decisions, de'oraita or de'rabanan. Is this a Torah-level transgression or a rabbinic transgression? Maybe I'm going to take a bigger risk if it's quote-unquote only a rabbinic transgression. Sveika, which is if you have two levels of uncertainty, then we're maybe going to be more lenient. All of these rules, all of these principles are ways of recognizing that we have basic uncertainties in reality and helping us cope and move our religious lives forward. But you can't like stay in the state of paralysis. Sure, God knows everything and God knows whether this piece of meat is kosher, but I don't. And at some point I'm going to have to make a decision. Can I or can't I? Should I or shouldn't I? And the end result is that we might sometimes do things that are halakhically quote unquote wrong, but it's procedurally correct. We got there in the right way. And so we go with that. But safek or doubt is also a religious category. It's not just a question of how to move forward with our lives. It's also deeply ingrained in our psyche as religious people. Again, because we know that we don't know everything. And also because we want to establish a religious infrastructure that gives us a kind of certainty in many areas, while kind of lifting up doubt and putting it in its own category. So feeling safek, recognizing and marking those places where we don't know, helps us appreciate the places where we do know. And as it turns out, Chazal did a lot of this work building off of laws in the Torah. They set up societal infrastructure for dealing with doubt. And they were part of society's religious consciousness, a way of knowing and marking the things that we know we don't know. In the course of the destruction of the temple, again, not the burning, not the parts that we most talk about, but in the course of the loss of the society that existed before the destruction of the temples, there was this recognition, there were these built-in pieces around safek that dwindle and disintegrate as the temples are destroyed. And that's what's accounted for at the end of the Mishnah in Masechet Sota. So again, it's not really so much about the destruction of the temple, but destruction of the entire Jewish way of life in the lead up to that destruction. The historical aspect of each Mishnah here is complex. It seems to deal primarily with the destruction of the second temple. But of course, there are resonances with first temple also. I'm not going to get into the historical details. We're going to look at that at these Mishnayot as literary units. But again, I think this is really the saddest account of what we lost with the loss of the temple. And I read it every year alongside Eicha. And I recommend it to all of you. We're only going to do a small piece, but there's a lot here. There's a lot to mourn for. Rituals changed, observances changed, people who passed away, and that marked sort of changes in society. So there's a lot in this text. I want to look at three losses in particular, three losses of the presence of safek that were torn down as we came closer to the destruction of the temple. On a moral, on a social, and an economic level, each one of these three is brought low in its own way. And I want to ask what it means for us that we've lost that. And in the spirit of holding out hope for redemption, I want to make sure we end with some thoughts about what it means to try to recreate or hold on to these systems of doubt, recognize them in our own world. So please take a look at the first text. I will share my screen, at least part of the time, although then I can't see you as well. I quoted here first from the Tosefta. I think the language is richer in the Tosefta, but it's paralleled in each case where I quote from the Tosefta, which again comes from the same time period as the Mishnah. I'm giving you the parallel texts in both. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Mishra Abu Haratzchanin, Batla Rufa. Lefisha Ena Gla Rufa, Ba Ela Al Hasafek. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who of course lived at the moment of the destruction of the Second Temple, according to the sources in the Talmud, said that once there were a lot of murderers, when the murderers multiplied, the ceremony of breaking the neck was nullified. Egla Arufa, which is described in the psukim that I put in source number 2, is a ritual that was meant to deal with a situation where a dead body is found, God forbid, out in the open, somewhere in essentially the middle of nowhere or in between two places, and nobody knows who killed that person. And it was a ritual that involved breaking the neck of a calf that was meant to mark the fact that, on the one hand, we, the leadership of these places, don't know who committed this murder. And on the other hand, that doesn't absolve us of all responsibility for coping with the fact that someone has been killed. And so there's a ritual that's described, again, in these psukim. You can take a look if you want. And what the Tosefta is telling us is that around this time, Chazal got rid of this ritual. They had to nullify it. Batla, right? That's the word that's used, that it was nullified. Lefisha ena gla rufa ba ela al hasafek, because breaking the neck of a calf, this ritual, this egla rufa ritual, is only done because of debt. Achshav rabu hahorgim begalui. At this point, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai tells us, at this point in Jewish history, there are just so many open murderers that it doesn't make sense anymore. It doesn't make sense to keep up this ritual. In other words, this ritual wasn't enacted in order to deal with murder. We actually know how to deal with murder, and there are other sections in the Torah that detail those laws. So there's capital punishment prescribed for murder that is done on purpose, and there's the cities of refuge, the Arei Miklat, for people who kill somebody by mistake. And there's a whole world, there's a whole halachic system in place for dealing with murder. This, the Egla Rufa, is not about dealing with murder. It's about dealing with uncertainty. It's about dealing with safek. And when you don't have safek anymore, you don't have this system. You don't have the basis for this system anymore. This first pasuk in Zvarim that details this ritual, ki matzeh halal ba'adama. If in the land that God gives you, by chance, a dead body is found, right? A dead person is found. That's how it starts. The Sifrei, the halachic midrash on Zvarim, says that ki matzeh, these words, if there should be found, if you should find, mean velo b'sha'asha matzui, not if this is generally found. This is a ritual, this is an enactment that's meant to deal with the case where once in a while, God forbid, you find a dead body in this way. And if that's happening all the time, if there are murders all the time, well then, this system just doesn't really apply at all. It's not relevant because that's not what it was created for. It was created for safek, for a society with safek, not for a society that has a lot of murderers. And that's really what this Tosefta is saying, right? We couldn't really hold on to this system anymore because it wasn't relevant because we just had so many kind of open murders. It's actually a question. The commentary on the Tosefta here raises the question, were there so many murderers or were there so many dead bodies? And what's the correlation between those two? Which was really the safek? The Tosefta makes it clear that what's happening is that there were so many murderers, but you know, potentially that also means that there were so many more dead bodies. But I think if it was just that there were so many more bodies being found, so that just means that, like, you know, at some point the system gets overwhelmed. That would be much more understandable, be much more easy for us to say, okay, sure. Like the elders of all these cities were just too busy to keep breaking the necks of all these calves. It seemed wasteful at some point. It seemed terrible at some point because there were so many dead bodies. The Mishnah and the Tosefta are very consciously using the language of there being too many murderers. It's not that the system became overwhelmed. It's just that the system could no longer stand up to this test because the whole system was about safek. It was about elevating the fact that we don't know who killed the person. If you think about whatever has happened in your own life, a moment of safek, a moment of being unsure, I don't want to put words in any of your mouths, so I'll say that for myself, I know that that feeling of uncertainty is sometimes an excuse to move quickly past the experience. to kind of brush it under the rug. I'd rather not dwell on the things that I don't know. I'd rather move past that. I'm not going to necessarily spend a lot of time digging in because I don't know. And I'd rather move on to the things that I do know. When something is unknown and feels unknowable, we might have a tendency to ignore it. And I would say parenthetically, sitting where I sit in Safaria, that the flip side of that is also true, that with the advent of digital technology, with the advent of algorithmic technologies, we tend to elevate the things that we do know and are knowable, even if they're less important, simply because we do know them. When it comes to something like Egla Arufa, this institution that is all around Safek, it's really trying to subvert that natural human tendency to brush things we don't know away and to ignore them. That it's a way of dealing with it. We've recognized that this happened. And also the Egla Arufa ceremony was meant to keep it in our consciousness, to keep it in our societal consciousness that this was happening, that this was ongoing, and that we had to recognize it and deal with it in some way that, again, elevated the Safek without just moving past it. I see that there's a question about how did they know there were many murderers without knowing who killed? So I think that's a good question. And ultimately, it's not clear from the sources. I think that's why, or it wouldn't be clear if they were just talking about too many dead bodies. But the idea here seems to be people were killing openly. Maybe they didn't know who was killing whom, but they knew that they had a lot of murderers in society. There was less shame around murder as a whole. And that was part of what went so wrong in society and what allowed this institution to be destroyed. So that's the first case that the Tosefta and the Mishnah in parallel introduce, again, to talk about what it looks like when a society that's been so carefully constructed, so carefully halakhically constructed, begins to break down. And I'll say also that if you look at the parallel text, I'll share my screen again. If you look at the parallel text in the Mishnah, which is, again, pretty much the same in this case as the Tosefta, but with one slight difference, Mishir Abu Haratzchanim Batla Agla Arufa. Here it says, batla, that it was nullified, and there's differences in language in some of these cases between whether it was nullified or they just stopped doing it. And you could say that one implies sort of a more active role than the other. Here, actually, relevant to the question, it names one of the murderers who they knew about. But it gives you the sense that there was this process going on that they really couldn't cope with, and at some point they had to just say, you know what, we can't do this Egla Arufa anymore. But you get the sense really of a society that's out of control. The second case that the Tosefta and the Mishnah deal with is around the ritual of the Sotah. So this, I also put, I put some of the psukim on the sheet in source number 8. Again, one of the reasons I'm in Safaria now is because I can click in and just look at the full, it's a long description, so I didn't put all of it. But this is current for us. This is in Bamidbar Perek Hay. So not that long ago, in terms of reading it. And this describes what happens if a man is jealous of his wife, feels that perhaps she's been unfaithful, and describes a whole temple ceremony of what should happen, because he's so worked up, because he's so upset. The man brings his wife to the priest, to the Kohen, to the temple, and there's a sort of sacrifice, a mincha offering that's brought, and a long ritual that's described. Again, this is predicated on the idea of safek. The safek is, did she or didn't she? The man suspects her, but he's not sure. If he were sure, if there were witnesses, then this wouldn't be happening. You wouldn't go forward with this procedure. And so the Tosefta says, Mishir Abu HaMenafim Pasku Mimarim. When adulterers multiplied, they stopped doing this bitter water ceremony. Lefi She'in Mimarim Ba'in Ela Al HaSafek. Because we only enact this bitter water ceremony when there is Safek, when there is doubt. Achshav Kfar Abu HaRo'in Bagalui. And here it's even clearer than with the murderers, I think, in terms of the language here. The open adultery multiply, right? You didn't have to wonder, were they, weren't they, what was happening? It's just the case that It's just the case that it was happening all the time. And so, and you knew, right? You could see, you weren't wondering. And so they got rid of this Mei Marim, of this bitter water ceremony. Again, even before the destruction of the temple, I think this is one of those things that we sometimes categorize, like it's a temple ritual. So like, obviously we had to stop doing it when there was no more Beit HaMikdash. But the Mishnah and the Tosefta are telling us it actually stopped before that. It stopped again when, not when the system became overwhelmed. And that's also to the point of the question that was asked, right? How can a Torah law be ignored because it becomes too burdensome to uphold? I don't think they're not ignoring it because it's too burdensome to uphold. It's actually the opposite. They could still have done it. Okay, maybe it's a lot more. The point is that the Torah ritual is predicated on the idea of there being uncertainty. Did she do it or not? Once you know, then there's no more Torah ritual. And that's true of the murders also. Once you get rid of that safek, then you can't have this. Now, presumably, maybe this is like a dan lekaf schut thing, but I'm going to say it anyway. Presumably, there were still people who were being accused where it wasn't true. Presumably, there were still people being killed where we didn't really know who the murderer was. In other words, like, I'm not sure there were no cases that were doubtful anymore. It's just there were so many cases that were certain that it didn't make sense anymore to maintain this ritual. And the Mishnah has a similar account, says basically the same thing. There were so many adulterers, so they stopped doing this. And it was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Mishnah adds, who nullified this practice. And the pasuk he quotes is from Hosea, Lo efkod al bnotichem, ki tiznena, ve'al kalotichem, ki tinafena, that there's, I'm not going to punish your daughters or your daughters-in-law when they commit adultery. If, this is the, here, I'll open the pasuk here so you can see it in full. The implication is that if there's so much adultery going on, if everybody is being adulterous, then we're not going to punish the women for also being adulterous. So you can see that the whole context here in Hosea is around the people not being faithful, both not being faithful to God, but also this ruach nunim, this idea that everybody is being unfaithful to partners. And so when the men are also adulterous, the women aren't going to be held accountable according to this source, right? It's really only something that we do when it comes about in a doubtful way. And the Gemara commenting on this Mishnah or elaborating on this Mishnah makes this really clear. So again, not in the sense of people giving up on an institution, but somehow it didn't work anymore once the men were also being unfaithful, or once you know with certainty that the uncertainty is not there. And so the end of the Gemara here, Amar lahem Navi Yisrael, so Rabbi Elazar says that what the Navi in Hosea is really saying is, Im atem makpidin al asmachem, mayim bodkin nashotechem. If you, male, are careful about yourself, if you're going to hold yourself to these standards of not being adulterous, then the water will work to check your wives. Mi'im lav in hamayim bodkin nashotechem. And if not, then the water isn't going to work. Like the magic was gone, you could say. The magic of the mesota, the magic of this ritual, of this temple ritual, was gone once it was no longer relevant. Once it was no longer the case that faithfulness was kind of like the default, right? That's how it should be, that we assume as default, right? If we don't have proof to the contrary, we assume that people are being faithful, that people are faithful to these relationships. But once that general premise is undermined, once we're no longer dealing with a few deviants in society, but we're really saying, no, like, this is not working at all, at that point, the ritual gets taken away. And so similar to the Eglah Arufah, there's a whole system that's built around Safek. And once that Safek is gone, is batel, is not really present anymore, then there's nothing there. You can't uphold that ritual anymore. Now, I want to say that maybe even more so than with Eglah Arufah. You know, Eglah Arufah is kind of like a bloody ritual. It's maybe a little hard to imagine, or maybe we might not all want to imagine it. Mesotab, which was denigrating, it seems, for the woman being suspected, that might be like a much harder one even to work up nostalgia for. And I think actually that's true of a lot of temple ritual, is that it's sometimes hard for us to work up nostalgia for them, because like if you haven't ever seen an animal being slaughtered, that might not be something that you're like excited about. And so again, I think what's interesting here is that is this idea that they were constructed around Safek, that what was being lost was not so much the ritual, but the idea that Safek was kind of ingrained in society, because the flip side is, right, there was a fair amount of certainty. You knew that as a default, if there was an unaddressed murder, that was rare, and that was going to get dealt with. And you knew that that people were basically not cheating on other people. And if that happened in a rare case, it was going to get dealt with. And that's really different from living in a society where you say, oh, that's like kind of the default. That's kind of just what we assume. And so we're not going to work on these things anymore. We're not going to name them. We're not going to call them out. We're sort of saying like, that's just a part of, it's like part of the wallpaper. I want to suggest that this does happen in our world as well, that you sometimes have changes for the negative. And when it first happens, everyone's like, oh, like that is a terrible thing. And then you get used to it, right? Kind of accommodate to it. And people stop calling out that thing that they once thought was terrible. In this case, it's not so much about things that are bad. The bad things were still happening, or the bad things were happening more. But again, it's about the loss of Safek. And so the inability to elevate that as a part of our lives, that every once in a while something happens and you just don't know, you just aren't sure. Instead, there's a certainty, but it's not the good kind of certainty. It's the bad kind of certainty. It's really a negative. I'm pausing for a minute to look at the questions and comments. I do not know anything about the divorce rate. And I think the Aguna question is a little outside the scope here, although I definitely think that the basic structures, right? Like the stronger the basic structures of halakhic society are, the more capable they should be of dealing with something like Aguna. And as to whether forbidden sexual behavior was more common among men, yeah, probably in the Bible, for sure, maybe in real life too. But again, I think here the emphasis is that whatever you think was happening in reality, the way that the Torah perceives it, it's like an outlier kind of situation. Sometimes you had these outliers. Sometimes you had these situations happen. And there was a ritual designed to say, you know what? We don't want to just let this unknown thing pass by. You could have imagined a Sotah ritual, by the way, that was just like a one-on-one with the Kohen, a one-on-one conversation with the priest. That's not what we did. And Eglah Rufa similarly wasn't a private ceremony. These were public. These were known. These were meant to say to everybody, hey, we have Safek in our lives. We have these situations of doubt, and we're going to take some time and dwell on it. And we have a process in place to deal with it. And sometimes we become inured to bad changes. And when these things started happening all the time, they just no longer met that threshold of being Safek, of being doubtful. And so there was no need to mark them. There was no need to recognize them. I really don't have any data, and I don't think anyone does, about how often the Eglah Rufa ceremony happened or how often the Sotah ritual happened. I want to hope that neither of those were frequent. But I think that if you, someone mentioned fake news, so without getting political, I'll just say, like, imagine if you opened up the newspaper, like you were someone who read the newspaper every day, and let's say once a year, twice a year, you saw in a headline, Eglah Rufa ceremony. Unsolved murder, must do Eglah Rufa ceremony, or Mesotah ceremony. These things would be part of your consciousness then as something that happens, and a way of kind of pausing as a society to contemplate that. And what was lost, again, in these two instances of destruction, and it doesn't give us a sense of the chronology here either, really, is that that no longer was able to happen. There was too much certainty about too many bad things happening. And so they got rid of both of those rituals. I think I answered all the questions. Okay. But again, I'm happy to take those if you have them. The third case that I want to speak with you about today is a kind of counterexample. I think it a little bit breaks the mold of the other two examples. You'll tell me if you think it's actually contradictory. I want to argue that it takes all of this a step further, even though on first glance it is kind of a different case. The Mishnah and the Tosafta raise the issue of Dmai, of a rabbinic institution that was meant to deal with a kind of a set of mitzvot in the Torah, but it's not mentioned in the Torah itself. And so it bears a little bit of explanation. Produce grown in the land of Israel is subject, of course, to Trumot and Maaserot, to various forms of tithes. Truma goes to the Kohen, to the priest, and that's a really small amount of the produce overall. Maaser Rishon, which is a tenth of what's left after the Truma is taken, goes to the Levi, who then takes Truma Maaser, who takes their own Truma from that and gives it to a priest. Maaser Sheni, which is the second tithe, has to be eaten in Jerusalem, except for in years 3 and 6 of the Shemitah cycle when it gets given to poor people, and that's called Maaser Ani. If this is all feeling kind of esoteric and a little bit like too much for a day when many of us are without caffeine, I would say like that's right, that this system also is something that, at least for those of us living outside of the land of Israel, is kind of a loss, right? We live, actually, we might all live in different places. I live, again, in Chicago, in a place where produce that's grown locally, which basically means in Wisconsin, is not subject to these rules. And also, Jews are less likely to live an agrarian lifestyle. And so, again, a lot of us could live perfectly normal and totally halakhically observant lives without really ever coming up against these rules. And I can say, as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, I was just in Israel. I just got back less than a week ago. And even living in Israel, and even in a Shemitah year, I would say you don't have to be so aware of this system of laws because we don't give things to Kohanim and Leviim anymore in the same way, because we don't grow our own produce. So there's a system in place to kind of take care of all of this. And it's not high in our consciousness anymore. There is a system that was instituted is as a result of a concern about whether Amei HaAretz, let's say, not as educated Jews, but that's kind of a modern anachronism, whether they were really taking all of these tithes, because it's a lot. Like what I just described to you, that's like a lot. You have to know a lot of laws just in order to grow your produce and sell your produce to other people. And so there's this institution, it's a whole tractate unto itself in the Mishnah called Dmai, that if you being somebody who knows exactly what you're doing with tithes, you being a chaver, somebody who is religiously scrupulous, you buy produce from an am haaretz, from somebody who's not in that camp, then you have to assume that they probably did some of their tithing, but not all of it. You can assume that they took truma, that they took this little bit that was given to the Kohen, but you have to take your own ma'aser rishon and take trumat ma'aser from that. And you also have to deal with your own ma'aser sheni, but basically you can keep all of that food for yourself. You separate it, but you can keep it for yourself. So it's like an in-between quasi kind of system, where you are recognizing that these tithes might not have been taken. You're kind of making sure that it kind of happens, but you're not demanding of the person selling you the produce, right? It's not like you're going up to them and saying, like, show me your hechsher. Explain to me exactly. I know how many of you have had that experience of going someplace where you're uncertain about a hashgacha, you're uncertain about a kashrut status and being like, wait, can you tell me exactly what did you do? What did you not do? This was actually seen by many as a way of creating a kind of unity among the Jewish people. I can buy my produce from anyone because I have like a standard procedure in place for how to deal with it. Even if I'm buying from somebody whose kashrut may not be on the same level as mine. Okay. that was a long explanation for this institution that, again, is like just discussed all over agricultural law in the Mishnah, and you know, maybe isn't necessarily normally associated with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay. But that's just so you understand the background here. What the Mishnah says, again, both Tosefta and Mishnah, here I'll start with the Mishnah, is that Yochanan the high priest, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, hevir hodayat ha-ma'aser. He did two things, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who is dated to different times by different people, but let's assume he's also in the lead up to the beginning of the end, or maybe the end of the end, of the destruction of the temple. He, first of all, got rid of Hodayat HaMa'aser, of the declaration of the tithe. This I didn't put on here because it might be a more familiar text to many, but I'll open it up on the side here. So there's what's called Vidui Ma'asrot, a kind of confession around Ma'aser after you biblical you who's bringing all these tithes in their proper time. After you do all of that, then you have this vidui, this confession, where you say to God, "Bi'artzi hakodesh min habayit, I cleared out all the consecrated portions from my house. V'gam netati v'levi v'lager le'atom v'la'amana, I gave them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow. K'chol mitzvatcha asher tzivitani, just like all the mitzvot that you commanded me. Lo avarti mimitzvatecha v'lo shachachti, I didn't do anything wrong. I did everything. I didn't forget anything." This, which again is referred to as vidui, is the confession of Ma'asrot, is sometimes contrasted, if we do all of this again in a few months for, or not even a few months, a few weeks in preparation for the high holidays, we could talk about comparing different kinds of confessions. This is the good kind of confession. You're not confessing all your sins. You're confessing, as it were, that you did everything absolutely correctly. And so Yochanan Kohen Gadol got rid of that declaration. That was step number one. And step number two, Uviyamav, Ein Adam Tzarich Lishol Al Hatzmai. And step number two is that in his time, nobody needed to ask about Tzmai. So the first one kind of makes sense. He got rid of this declaration. We have to ask in a second, why did he do that? The second one, in the context of the Mishnah, and again, you're welcome to, you can open up these Mishnayot and spot check me if you wish. You can click on the link and open it in Safari. These Mishnayot seem to be describing a negative process, right? A process of the breakdown of society. So, in Adam Tzarich Lishol Al Hatzmai, you don't need to ask about Tzmai. That like doesn't fit the pattern so well. What exactly are we saying? Was this a good thing? It's not so clear. Also, the whole point of Tzmai, as I hope I just explained to you, is that you didn't have to ask questions. Right? That was like literally the institution of Tzmai, was that you didn't have to ask questions. You could just buy the food, not ask, did you tithe, didn't you tithe? Because the default assumption was you probably didn't tithe k'mo shetzarich, right? You didn't tithe in exactly the way that you were supposed to, but that's okay because I'm equipped to deal with that because Chazal built this whole system called Tzmai. So it's very unclear. Both of these pieces are unclear, right? Why did he get rid of the declaration? And what does it mean in Tzarich Lishol Al HaTzmai that you didn't have to ask about Tzmai? I'd say that both the Tosefta and the Gemara shed light on this, and we're going to look at all of the things in this case. So the Tosefta says, Af hu gazar al havadai, that he decreed about the certainty. If you look at the Hebrew, or even if you just listen to the words vadai and vidui, you can hopefully hear how those sound very similar. And the commentaries here suggest that this vadai, this word here, is actually a mistake. It shouldn't say vadai, it should say vidui. And then it matches up with the Mishnah where it says hodayat ha-ma'aser, right? The confession around the ma'aser. But it's very interesting, I think, even if it's a mistake, I think it's really interesting that the Tosefta uses the word vadai, that in this case, what was decreed about was the certainty, right? He got rid of certainty. Why did he get rid of certainty? Pausing on that one for a second. So the Gemara explains that in the time of the Second Temple, the Levi'im didn't all go back to Jerusalem, back to the temple, in the way that the prophets had hoped. And so Ezra HaSofer, Ezra the scribe and the prophet, instituted a knas, like a fine, it's like a system of demerits, right? He was like scolding the Levim and said, no, let's not give them any of the things that are really owed to them in the Truma Maser process. If we do that, then when we go back to that Vidui Masrot, you can't do that, right? You can't make that confession because it's not really true. And that's what the Gemara is saying. Again, this is the Gemara in Sota working with the Mishnah, but the Tosefta is just a different version of the Mishnah. And so the Gemara here says, Amar Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Chanina lefisha eino tzinino to ketzikuno. Terachmana amar zehava levim. Ve'anan kaya havinan lekohanim. The Torah says that we should give it to the Levim, but we actually give it to the Kohanim. And so there's a long discussion in the Gemara, like, could you do like a half confession, right? Could you say, instead of getting up and saying, God, I did everything you asked me to do, could you get up and say, God, I did like 90% of what you asked me to do? Personally, I feel like 90% would be pretty good, higher than maybe we normally get. But the implication is, the Gemara explains, no, like that's not what Vidui Masrot is for. You can't get up and say, I did most of it. You just don't do it at all. And so the Kohen Gadol got rid of this declaration. Here, what we really see is an erosion of a vadai, an erosion of something that's certain, not so much an erosion of doubt. And I see that there's a question about whether the Kohen Gadol can do that. Yeah, apparently the Kohen Gadol can do that. Seems like no one stopped him. So that's an erosion of certainty, but you'll see how the flip side is also true. So in the Tosefta's telling, the flip side is Ubitel et Hadzmai. He nullified Dzmai, which makes more sense than in Tzarich Lishol al Hadzmai. It makes more sense than not having to ask about Dzmai. He actually nullified this practice. And the reason, according to the Tosefta, is that he sent messengers out and found that people weren't really doing this. And the rest of the description kind of seems like what he did was institute Dzmai. And the Gemara is concerned about this juxtaposition. Like, did he institute Dzmai or did he get rid of Dzmai? Which is it? And again, Dzmai is the system that allows you to buy produce from people who you think are not completely tithing correctly. So it's a question, right? What is it that you were supposed to do now? So the Gemara describes this long process of he goes out, he sees that people are not doing it correctly. He sent messengers through the land of Israel. And in the end, the Gemara says, no, tarte tiken. He made two tekanot, bitel vidui de chavirim, the gazar al dmai shal amei ha'aretz. This makes it sound like a kind of balanced system. For the people who are asking about, like, you know, can the Kohen Gadol really do this? Yes, the Kohen Gadol has religious leadership and can say, listen, you chavirim, you people who are so confident about your own religious practice, you're not actually doing everything perfectly. So you're not going to get to make the Vidui Masrot anymore. You're not going to get to make this statement of God, we did everything totally correctly. And on the flip side, the Amei Ha'aretz, everybody else who maybe would never have made that declaration to begin with, they're going to have this institution of Dzmai, and they're going to have to sell this produce, knowing or with everybody sort of on board with the fact that not all the tithes were taken. Again, this is maybe the way, this is the way that it happened. It's a little bit confusing as an explanation of the words bitel et hadzmai, right? That he nullified dzmai. Again, coming back to the question, did he nullify it or did he just reinforce it? I think, given the way that this fits into the flow of the rest of the cases in the Mishnah and in the Tosefta, I think it's more likely that what we're talking about is a kind of nullification. That language of Bitel also fits with the previous two cases. And I want to convince you, it's okay. I mean, I'm generally a fan of the Bavli, so I think it's okay if you want to go with the Bavli's account. But I'm hoping to convince you that the account in the Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, is a little bit more compelling. And in this case, we're told that same beginning of the story. Yochanan Kohen Gadol shalach ubadak b'chol arei Yisrael. Yochanan the Kohen Gadol sent messengers out to all of the cities of Israel and found that they weren't they were only taking Truma Gdola. They were only taking that first Truma that's given to the Kohen. And all the other gifts, they weren't necessarily taking. But in this story, and it tells a little bit about how exactly it's supposed to work, in this version of the story, the Gemara says, Ubi amav, ein adam tzarich lishol al hadmai, shehem midzugot, that nobody needed to ask about dmai, because he, the Kohen Gadol, set up zugot, literally, or pairs. Seems like he instituted a new kind of hashgacha system, right? Like whatever your local va'ad is that provides kashrut certification for your restaurant, insert their name here. He started that, but for the entire land of Israel. And he sent people out to actually make sure that people were tithing in the way that was appropriate. Dmai, again, was a system of standardizing safek, of allowing it to exist in the world, and saying, yeah, no, just like when you go buy produce, you just assume that certain things weren't done, you take it home, you tithe, you're good to go. This Kohen Gadol was not satisfied with that system. And instead he said, no, look, I'm going to put into place this great system where people are going to be observing the Yemei Haaretz, where they're going to be observing normal people, normal farmers at all times, so that they can intervene if they don't tithe appropriately. Good idea, bad idea? You can decide what you think. The Gemara actually debates this a little bit. The Yerushalmi specifically says, Lignai, Milti Derbi Yeshua ben Levi Amram, Mehen Lignai Umehen Lishvach. Some of these things were said Lignai negatively, and some were said as praise. In other words, the Yerushalmi is getting at this question, like, why would we stop and say something good about the process when up until now we've only been saying bad things? So the Yerushalmi says, yeah, we do go back and forth a little bit. But spoiler alert, for those of you who maybe thought that the increased scrutiny was a good thing or could be a good thing, it did not turn out that way. Once they sent people out to do this kind of hashgacha, to do this kind of like watching, right? You had people there to just like watch to make sure that things were going well. It stopped going well because part of the setup of dmai is that once you buy the produce, you separate out the appropriate tithes, but you don't have to give them to somebody else. And so certain of the pairs that were sent out started taking. Hayuno tzlino tan bizroa. They would just take the produce for themselves. They would come to these storehouses and they would take it. V'hayu sipe kan biyadol limchot v'lo micha. And the Kohen Gadol could have intervened. He could have censured, I think is the English here. He could have stopped them from doing that. He could have said, this is not appropriate behavior. This is not what I sent you out to do. And in fact, that's not what happened. He let this go. And so we wound up with a system where, there's a kind of attempt to ensure religious stringency, to ensure religious standards. And instead, what we end up with is a total breakdown of the system entirely. Instead, what we wind up with is a system where the people who were meant to be enforcing a kind of high-level kashrut end up being corrupt, taking the produce for themselves, presumably with negative economic consequences. The Gemara doesn't really go further into this, other than, again, having sort of established that, yeah, like this was a part not of, this wasn't like a save by the high priest. This was a part of the overall degradation of society. Yeah, I see one of the comments that came in, the more things change, right? So unfortunately, I think corruption in society, corruption particularly in areas where people stand to make money is not something that's like foreign to us or crazy. Maybe if anything, what's amazing is that the system of dmai worked at all. And again, I don't have can't tell you like a year in which it started and a year at which it ended, but you could imagine again, this kind of elevation of a kind of comfort with safek. I don't know whether or not you tithed. I just don't know. You may have, you may not have. And instead of trying to get to the bottom of that safek, instead of trying to, again, going back to the previous cases, instead of making sure that I can't always catch the murderer, I can't always know for sure what somebody else has done without my seeing. I can't always know for sure whether or not they tithed. But what we can do is build these institutions in society that allow us to recognize that, elevate that, think about it for a moment, and then let it go because we know how to proceed. And instead, there's kind of this religious crackdown where that's not what happens. And so instead, what does end up happening is that, you know, presumably, right, people just can't sell their produce in that way anymore, right? The whole system just entirely breaks down. And so it's both the vidui and the vadai. It's both the confession and the certainty, and also the uncertainty are what's lost. I like this as a final case because it really seems clear there that a part of what went wrong here was the focus on certainty. And I guess in the question that I feel one of the commenters in the chat was sort of getting at, right? Like who is this high priest figure? How bad or good was he? I think this is also why the Yerushalmi is like not sure whether to count this as a demerit or not at first for Yochanan Kohen Gadol, because you could imagine that in a world where certainty felt less possible, that people wanted it more. And ultimately that was impossible. I think that's true for us also, that we know we might not raise up doubt in the same way. We don't have the same structures for recognizing safek, but we do know that there's so much that we don't know. And the more uncertainty exists in our world, the more we want to hold on to certainty where we can. And there's a real value in maintaining our religious humility, or in building our religious humility, maybe in some cases, and knowing that there are things that we don't know, and knowing that we need to dwell on those uncertainties in some moments. Without these components, not only these, but also these, Egla Rufa, Mesota, Zmai, and all the categories they represent, again, moral, social, economic, without all those components built into our lives, it's harder. It's harder to hold on to that knowledge of uncertainty and harder to maintain religious humility. And I think, yes, comments that came to me privately, as well as some of those that were shared with the group, I think that we do see that as a kind of ongoing form of destruction, as a desire to crack down. Did you or didn't you? I want to know exactly what you did. I want to be able to see into your life. And by the way, we have like great technologies that can help us do that or make us feel like we can do that. Yeah, I do kind of think the consequence of a lack of safek is sometimes chumra. That's a good point, Rochelle, that's something that happens. And it just, right, the less we know, the more we have this like built up desire. No, I'm going to make you tell me. I'm going to know. I'm going to look. I'm going to see for sure. And so without these components of safek built into our lives, we have to work that much harder to keep ourselves honest, to recognize the things that we don't know, again, on all of these levels. We lose doubt as part of everyday life, as an elevated part of everyday life. And it becomes something that it's on us, really. We don't have these institutions. It's on us to rescue those and to call those out and to name the things that we know that we don't know, and make sure that we're kind of incorporating them as part of our religious lives, as part of our religious humility as a whole. I think I answered all the questions that came in on the chat, but I think we also have 1 or 2 minutes for questions if people have more. But I'll just say that I'm glad we got to read these Makorot together today. In the interest of time, moved through some of them quickly, but again, really recommend opening up either the Mishnah or the Tosefta or both as some really truly humbling sources to read through on Tisha B'Av.
Thank you. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Rick, you have 1 minute for questions, additional questions you didn't answer, if anybody has. Otherwise, we'll take a couple minute break. Rabbi Mintz, are you here somewhere? I think you're here. Can unmute
yourself?
Yes,
I am here.
Okay.
I'm nice here and I'm unmuted.
Okay, good. But I hear you're unmuted. Okay, very nice. Okay. All right, any questions for Sarah? Otherwise, we'll say thank you very much. And we appreciate it. And I guess I'm sorry you have an extra hour to fast living in Chicago. But
I'm behind all of you.
You're behind an hour. Okay, what can you do? But anyways, all right. Thank you very much, really. Very nice. Safek. Safek. Yeah. That's a hard sugyot, but you didn't get, of course, into the halakhic aspects of those. But as you know.
Next
Thank
time.
You very much. Yeah, next time. Yeah. Okay, we'll take a 3-minute break, everybody, and everybody can stretch a little, and we'll come back, and Rabbi Mintz will be speaking on how the Crusades became part of Tisha B'Av. Okay, so we'll start in a couple minutes.